I wonder if there are records here that no one's ever listened to.
Ah, ça, c'est une bonne question.
Oui, c'est une bonne question. Mais il y en aura d'autres dans l'émission de ce soir, quelques-unes, et des réponses surtout. Grell Marcus sort les vinyles de leur pochette, patiemment. Les vinyles de la discothèque de Radio France, le stock où on s'est installé, il les place sur la platine, en face de lui, et il en parle tout simplement.
C'était en 45 tours.
Comme une synthèse, une réduction de ce qu'il n'a jamais cessé de faire, comme rock critique californien de légende. Oui, on peut dire ça comme
Sorry,
ça.
I knew this was gonna happen.
Écouter, yeah, parler de ce qu'on écoute, okay, le mettre en perspective, dire ce qu'on ressent, partager.
All right.
Bonsoir à vous et bienvenue.
Well, here we go. Close.
Come on, you good time people.
People have often said that music critics are frustrated musicians, which isn't true at all. Music critics are frustrated disc jockeys.
Bon, on va essayer de soigner cette frustration alors en partie ce soir avec vous. Il faut le dire parce qu'on ne l'a pas dit, vous avez été critique, un des critiques fondateurs quasiment du magazine Rolling Stone à partir de 68, aussi du magazine Cream. Et vous avez fait partie, vous faites partie de ces quelques critiques, en particulier américains, qui ont légitimé la culture rock, qui ont légitimé le rock. Aujourd'hui, si le rock et la culture pop au sens large devient un objet d'étude, c'est parce que vous avez ouvert les portes, vous avez ouvert ces portes-là. Et d'une certaine manière, est-ce qu'on peut dire que ça a changé le rock lui-même, qu'il devienne objet d'études et de critiques?
I don't know. It was never my intention to make rock and roll an object of study. People have often said to me, this ought to be taught in colleges. And I've said, no, it shouldn't. College is for stuff that people won't find out about on their own. People are going to find out about this on their own. College is for studying literature. College is for studying history. We don't need to teach rock and roll. We don't even need to teach blues or jazz in college. This is a world for enthusiasts, for obsessives. People will find their own way. They'll gather their own knowledge. I've always believed that. I never meant to do anything about this music, but write about it, because I wanted to write about it, not to accomplish something, not to make anything legitimate or seem better than it was. It was already great. It just took, you know, somebody with an open mind to realize that. I don't mean me, you know, anybody, lots of people. And so I don't see it that way, not at all. You know, writing about rock and roll should be fun before it's anything else. It should be exciting. It should be inspiring. It should be scary, just like any writing. It should provoke emotions and lead people to think about things they wouldn't think about otherwise, not specific things. You don't write so that someone will think good thoughts or agree with you. You write so that they will respond in the world in their own way, just as you as a reader respond in ways that the writer you're reading could never have expected, anticipated, or intended. Writing is a free field, and any writing with a purpose to it is going to be, to some degree, stillborn from the beginning. I guess that's kind of redundant.
Je vous propose, Grell Marcus, d'ouvrir cette boîte, la boîte à vinyle. Fermé à clé, évidemment. Voilà. Hop. Alors, évidemment, il y a quelques Bob Dylan, parce que ce qui se passe en ce moment, c'est que vous sortez la version française de Bob Dylan par Grell Marcus aux éditions Galahad, et j'imagine que ce sera une figure qui sera présente dans notre conversation.
I hope so. Well, this is going to take me a moment. find out what's here. Well, this is a wonderful Elvis collection that came out, I'm not sure, it came out in the 70s before he died. And it's such a fantastic overview of his entire career. It's got some really terrible stuff on it and some really great stuff on it. Tonight's All Right for Love. It's one of the worst things he ever did. You know, they put, you know, really impressive garbage on here, along with stuff that, you know, will never be forgotten. Maybe we could listen to a little bit of Trying to Get to You. The thing is this is an unreleased live version. So I don't even know what this will be. Maybe we should just listen to it.
Allons-y.
Trying to Get to You. Let's see. It's on it's the last track on the first side. I can't see this at all.
Ça a l'air d'être bon.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, this is from 1968.
I've been traveling over mountains, even through the valleys too. I've been traveling night and day. I've been running all the way, maybe trying to get to you. Ever since I Lord above, you know I love you. It was he who brought me through. Oh, my way was dark at night, I would shine as bright as light.
That was one of the songs he recorded at Sun in 1955. And here it is, 1968. And he lets loose in that song. I'm sorry we can't play the whole thing, but I moved it from the beginning to the end because it just takes off at the end, the last three choruses. He is so thrilled. He is so satisfied. He's so gratified, not just to be in front of a wonderful audience, which he is, surrounded by people who are crazy about what he's doing, which he is. But it's as if he always knew there was more to this song than he ever got back in 1955, and he's got it now. That's as great as any recording he ever made, maybe the greatest. And that's what's so wonderful about this collection, the worst and the best. You know, they don't hedge their bets.
Pour vous, quand un album comprend des chansons totalement réussies et en même temps des chansons sabotées, ce que vous dites parfois, certains albums de Bob Dylan, pour vous, c'est une énigme?
No, it's odd. It's odd for a record company to put together such a, let's call it a critical edition, in the sense that this whole album is a wonderful example of rock criticism on the part of a record company. Somebody very smart and somebody who was having a really good time put this together.
L'objet vinyle, l'objet, la pochette, le disque 33 tours, ça représente quelque chose pour vous? C'est important?
No, this is an annoyance. You have to work much too hard to find out what's actually here. You have to go through the booklet because they don't list the tracks on the label. And here's this very elaborate booklet.
Pour vous, l'incarnation de la musique, c'est pas
le disque. I'm looking for an outtake Visions of Johanna. And here it is. It's on side 7, track 3. See, this will take us all day. Side 7. But there are only 4 sides here. Here we go. He recorded, Bob Dylan recorded a lot of versions of this song, and they were all completely different. The one that was released on Blonde on Blonde in 1966, it's very spare, it's very doomstruck. It's about these people in a loft in Manhattan. It's probably 3 a.m., and some people are taking drugs, and some people are having sex, and some people are fast asleep, and other people are looking out the window, and nobody's going anywhere, and nobody cares, in a way. It's this fantastic expression of bohemian gloom. And it's completely haunted. But other versions, there's one that's just beautiful, gorgeous. It's much too gorgeous for the story the song is telling. And this version, what's different about this version is that it's enraged. In other words, it's in the lyrics, it's the same picture of the same room. But instead of the narrator describing what's in the room, this narrator is furious at what is what he and everybody else is doing with their lives, which is to say, wasting them. So let's see if I have it right. A great song by itself. Well, okay, my mistake. Here we go. See? They're messing with us. Oh, this is side 5. No wonder. I said rock critics are frustrated DJs. This rock critic is a bad DJ. I think we're wasting a lot of time here. Okay, this is side 6. This should be sides. No, this is 5. This is very interesting. See, what you've got here, what you've got here is an elaborate box set. It cost a lot of money. And what have we got on it? We have this beautiful packaging, but the same discs on each side. Instead of 5, 6, 7, 8, you've got 5, 6, and you've got 5, 6. So if anyone had ever played this before, they would have said, I'm taking this right back to the record store. So we have spent all this time looking for something that ought to be here, but isn't.
Vous demandiez si certains disques n'avaient jamais été écoutés. Manifestement, celui-ci, c'est le cas.
Doesn't look like it. All right, let's see if we can find side 4. If this has the actual sides it's supposed to have. Here is side 4.
Donc là, vous avez choisi. C'est quoi?
This is the coasters. This is probably, this is going to be something like 1958. Here we go. Idol with a golden head.
Call myself an idol with a golden head.
Great big idol with a golden head.
Put it on the shelf right above my bed.
Great big idol with a golden head.
Got down on my knees and began to pray.
Great big idol with a golden head.
I said, idol, tell me where's my big foot made.
Great big idol with a golden head.
The idol's eyes began to wink and blink.
Great big idol with
he said, oh, hold on, Jim, give me time to think.
Great big idol with a golden head.
The lightning flashed and the idol did speak.
Great big idol with
the Coasters were a black vocal group, mostly from Los Angeles. That's why they're called the Coasters, because they're from the West Coast. And all their songs were written by and produced by Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller.
Sitting on my shelf.
Oh, gee, what did you see?
Went down to the creek to see for myself.
Oh, gee, what did you see?
I parked my car and I looked around.
Oh, gee, what did you see?
There was a mess of empty beer cans laying on the ground.
Their records got more and more ridiculous. And that's an example of one of their more ridiculous records. Let's write a song about an idol with a golden head. It sounds like something from an Uncle Scrooge comic book. And that's a lot of what rock and roll was and, you know, at its best always is. It's ridiculous. It is pointless. It has no purpose. It has no meaning. Except it reaches you and it makes you feel different than you felt before. It makes you feel, you know, like you want to rush right out and, you know, see what's never been seen, say what's never been said, and maybe sing a song about a great big idol with a golden head.
Rockin' and a rollin',
rockin' and a rollin', hoppin' and a poppin' and a poppin' and a jumpin' and a hoppin'.
C'est ça que vous, c'est ce genre de choses que vous vous écoutiez avec quand vous étiez au lycée. Votre ami Barry Franklin, par exemple, avec qui vous...
With
vous
Barry parlez, Franklin, vous Barry lui, will be thrilled to hear his name mentioned on the show. Barry Franklin was my high school cruising buddy. We would drive around at night, every night after school, listening to the radio for hours and hours, talking about the songs we were hearing in 59, 1960. And I certainly listened to the Coasters on the radio in the 1950s, but I didn't hear this song until it was collected, you know, on an album in the, you know, probably 1970. I don't know if this was ever released as a single. If it was, it wasn't a hit. So I never heard that. I discovered this way later. I was in touch with Barry Franklin, my high school music friend, yesterday. He sent me the most frightening video I've ever seen in my whole life. It was 20, 30, or 40 washed-up TV stars from the 80s and 90s. Today, all of them lip-syncing to the Beatles' Let It Be. And just one person after another. And they all looked completely blank. They looked like zombies. It was like an ad for Scientology. It was just completely excruciating. The worst moment for me was Philip Michael Thomas. He was the other detective on Miami Vice, playing the most histrionic air guitar imaginable. And I just had to cover my eyes. You know, I can watch violence in a movie. This time, I really had to go like that. I couldn't bear to look at it.
Oui, mais justement, ça pose une question qui est le rapport aux figures pop du passé. Et j'ai l'impression que dans vos livres, dans vos critiques, dans vos livres, ces figures-là restent au présent. C'est-à-dire ce que vous, vous sortez d'elles, ce que ça signifie maintenant.
Yeah, because I'm not a historian. I don't say, then this happened and then that happened. And now we'll move on to something else. When I'm writing about music, I'm writing about listening to it whenever that might be. And that is a present moment. And the music is heard in the present moment. It affects the present moment. And whatever I have to bring to bear on it is what I have to bring when I'm 32, 47, 22, 68. And so I'm going to have a different point of view and a different things to say. I hope. Mm-hmm. I hope when I'm listening to something today that I wouldn't say the same things and wouldn't feel the same things as I would have said or would have felt 30 years ago. Not that the experience would be altogether different. I want to feel that same thrill, but I'm just going to hear it differently. Mm. Bob Dylan once said a marvelous thing about folk music, but it applies to any music, any artistic experience that demands engagement from the viewer, the spectator, the reader, whoever it might be. And I think music demands engagement more than any other art form. Anyway, he said, a folk song has 1,000 faces, and you have to meet them all. And he said, and no song sounds the same at any given time. It depends on who's playing and who's listening. So this stuff is all unstable. We're unstable, and we bring, you know, our own doubts to everything. I'll play you a moment that probably everybody listening to this program knows, everybody has heard, everybody has, you know, responded to or not responded to, whatever it might be, but. For me, it is the signal moment in rock and roll. It is the moment more than any other that says something is about to happen. And all it is the first few seconds of Like a Rolling Stone. There is that drumstick coming down on a snare drum, in impossibly loud, but also sharp. But also an isolated sound, not a blurred sound, but something absolutely definitive. And then there is a lift. There is a fanfare. And it's not composed as a fanfare. It's not conducted as a fanfare. It is felt as a fanfare and has the effect of a fanfare. But instead of da-dun-da-da, 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 that's a fanfare. This is over in seconds, half a second, 2 seconds, and yet it communicates as much as a conventional John Philip Sousa fanfare, and really far more. This record begins with a promise. Something is about to happen. A story is about to be told. A life is about to be lived. And as the record goes on, it keeps all those promises. But the beginning, where the promise is made, is maybe the most thrilling and delicious moment of all. So we'll listen to this, and I'll be able to get it right because it's the first track on the album.
Allons-y alors pour Like a Rolling Stone.
So there you go. There you go.
No, on continue.
Well, we'll start it again.
No, continue.
Once upon a time, you dressed so fine, threw the bumps of dime in your prime. Then you. People call, say beware doll, you're bound to fall, you thought they were all kidding you. You used to laugh about everybody that was hanging out. Now you don't talk so loud.
so proud about having to be scrounging your next meal. How does it feel? How does it feel to be without a home? Like a complete unknown, like a rolling stone. But you know you only used to get juiced in it. Nobody's ever taught you how to live out on the street, and now you're gonna have to get used to it. You say you never compromise with the mystery tramp, but now you realize he's not selling it. As you stare into the vacuum of his eyes and say, do you want to make a deal? Let other people get your kicks for you. You used to ride on a chrome horse with your diplomat, who carried on his shoulder a Siamese cat. Ain't it hard when you discover that he really wasn't where it's at? After he took from complete unknown, like
Vous dites qu'il y a au moins trois énigmes posées par cette chanson. C'est le format, qui n'est pas du tout dans les formats radio de l'époque. C'est le titre, Rolling Stone, Like a Rolling Stone, au point que vous dites dans le livre que vous avez consacré à Bob Dylan à cette époque-là, Bob Dylan à la croisée des chemins, qui est un livre que vous dédiez à la radio d'ailleurs, certains ont dit il veut rejoindre le groupe, les Rolling Stones, alors que le titre peut venir de je crois que c'est Muddy Waters au début des années 50 qui a fait une chanson qui s'appelle Rolling Stone. Donc il y a aussi cette référence-là. Et puis certains disent qu'il a recyclé les accords de la Bamba de Ritchie Valens, qui est aussi donc une manière de recycler quelque chose qui, en fait, vous dites, continue de circuler et à un moment donné a été incarné, incorporé par Bob Dylan.
Let's put it this way. Phil Spector, I think, was the first person to say about Like a Rolling Stone, and he said this very snidely. Somebody, I think Jan Wenner, the editor of Rolling Stone, was interviewing him. He said something like, well, let's talk about Bob Dylan. He said, yeah, well, Bob Dylan's never really been produced well. This is somebody I could do a good job with. Like a Rolling Stone, you know, pretty good song, not that great a record. But it's always very satisfying to rewrite the chords of La Bamba. You know, it's a very snide comment. Dylan himself later talked about doing just that. Well, great. I've listened to that song probably 4,000 or 5,000 times. I've never heard that. I don't hear it. Now, I don't have the ears of Phil Spector. But I'm hearing something, you know, that's alive on its own terms. I don't care where the title came from. When I first heard of this record, before I'd heard it, that same high school friend, Barry Franklin, who we were talking about a few minutes ago, wrote me a letter, and he said, have you heard that Bob Dylan's written a song about the Rolling Stones, made a record about the Rolling Stones? And so, no, I hadn't heard that. But, you know, there are lots of mysteries in any real piece of music. And when I was listening just now, you talk about my writing about records that were made a long time ago in the present tense. I'm listening to this just now, and I'm listening to the guitar playing by Mike Bloomfield that people have always talked about. I'm listening to the organ playing by Al Kooper that people have always talked about. But what I'm really hearing is the drumming by Bobby Gregg, which, as far as I'm aware of, nobody ever talks about. And what I'm hearing happening here, the dynamics of the performance, is that in the middle of every verse, Bobby Gregg, not at the end, not when the chorus is coming, in the middle, Bobby Gregg creates a hill right in the middle of the song that everyone else is going to have to climb. And it's this challenge that suddenly appears in the song, and people are reaching and reaching, and they're playing more urgently, and they're playing more intensely, and they get to the top of the hill, and Bobby Gregg then plays a pattern that tips them over the hill, and they go right on down it. It's a tremendously visual moment, a kinetic moment, a moment where, you know, you're seeing soldiers on a battlefield, and they can't stop. They have to keep going, and here's this obstacle, and they're going to go over it. And that happens again and again in this song. So everybody is making a contribution that he couldn't have expected before. What we just listened to was, this song was recorded over 2 days. The first day, they got nowhere. Dylan was playing piano. Every take collapsed. They never got through more than two verses. Usually, they didn't even get through one verse. The singing was awful. The words were jumbled. Nothing ever came together. So they called it quits, and they came back the next day, and the producer brought in a couple of different musicians, some of the same people, some different people. And this time, Dylan was playing electric guitar. Somebody else, Paul Griffin, was playing piano. And they kept at it again. And again, you know, they'd stop after a verse, half a verse. They might get through two verses, and I think they got through two verses two or three times, but they could never get any farther. The song would just break. They'd lose the feeling. They'd lose the beat. It didn't work. And then at a certain point, you know, maybe the 16th take, the 17th take, I don't remember, they get all the way through the song for the first time. And one of the things you realize when you listen to the record is when you get past the second verse, nobody has ever been here before. They hadn't rehearsed this. They hadn't worked it out. They were just trying to find the song. And they get into the third verse, and it's unknown territory. Musicians don't know what Dylan's going to sing. Dylan doesn't know what the musicians are going to do. The musicians don't know if this song has four verses or 14 verses. They haven't heard the song. And so it is this, you know, it is this, adventure in surprise. And it is a continuum of surprises. And every moment in this record is an event. In other words, it's something that couldn't have been anticipated and now can't be taken back and also can't be repeated. That's what an event is. They get to the end of it. Wow, they got to the end of the song. Okay, let's keep going. Let's, you know, that's a take, but let's get more takes. And they keep doing it. And the rest of the afternoon, they only get through the whole song one more time, and it's a complete mess. The first time this song was ever played in its entirety is the version that was released and that we were just listening to. And I write about this song or any other song in the present tense because of that sense of event. Something happened, it couldn't have been predicted, and it can't be repeated.
Miguel Marcus, j'ai l'impression que la notion d'événement, elle est fondamentale pour vous, dans le sens où, là, il y a le cas de Like a Rolling Stone, mais les moments de concert, qui sont des événements, des performances, les moments de concert sont des moments de bascule pour vous. En tout cas, les moments de bascule dont vous parlez dans vos livres sont souvent des concerts. Il y a ce concert en 63 où vous croisez Bob Dylan. Il y a le concert fin 76 avec les Sex Pistols, qui est le point de départ de votre livre Lipstick Traces. Et vous parlez même d'un concert en 86 de Sonic Youth, qui est aussi un moment important pour vous. C'est des moments de révélation, ça peut, plus qu'une écoute d'un disque.
I don't really think I understand the concept of a tipping point. There are moments that where something crystallizes, where something comes together, and it becomes an experience that you can't ever forget, and that you will go over and over, maybe for the rest of your life. Not just remembering something, not thinking back in fond nostalgia, but really asking yourself over and over, what happened? What happened that night? What was it that so affected me? I remember how I felt, but I don't know how that happened. And you maybe want to solve that mystery, and you never will, but you'll keep asking. And certainly, with the first time I saw Bob Dylan in the summer of 63 when I'd never heard of him and didn't even hear his name when he came out on stage to play, what happened that day was never a mystery. I understood what was going on. It was a moment of revelation, but it was perfectly clear what it was about. With the Sex Pistols at their last show, the last show they ever played in San Francisco in 1978, that was one of those mysteries I had to write a 500-page book to unravel or try to. There was a Bob Dylan show I saw in December of 65 when he was touring with the Hawks, who would later become the band. And the same drummer we were listening to just now, Bobby Gregg, who played on Like a Rolling Stone, was playing with them. And I have to say, it's the only time in my whole life, in the middle of this concert, that I hallucinated. Not because I was, using any drugs. It was purely musical. But I'm sitting in this small little theater, holds about 2,000 people. And they're playing, really, really loud and wonderfully. Everything is lucid in the sound. Nothing is smeared. Everything is there. And they're playing It Ain't Me, Babe, which is a song that Dylan almost never played with the band again. Because they were trying out, which of my songs are going to work as rock and roll? Which of my songs are going to work with a band? And they didn't know. So they're doing It Ain't Me, Babe. And at a certain point, I felt that the roof had lifted off the building and was floating in the air, and the stars were coming down into the building. And this wasn't a thought. It was a physical feeling. And I looked up and I saw all of this.
Vous avez vécu une métaphore, en fait.
No, it wasn't a metaphor. I experienced an experience. something happened. It wasn't a metaphor for anything. I can't tell you what those images meant, and I never cared. What I cared about was the roof coming off the place. I mean, my God. And when the concert was over, I was on the bottom floor. My brother, who was 4 years younger than I was, this was 65, so I was 20 and he was 16. He comes running down from the balcony and we see each other in the lobby. And he turns to me and he says, "It ain't me, babe." And I said, "Right." And he hadn't experienced the same hallucination, but he'd experienced the same sensation of transportation, of being taken somewhere else in the middle of that song. It was in the instrumental break. It wasn't when Dylan was singing. It was when Robbie Robertson hit certain notes. Well, years later, many years later, a bootleg of that very concert came out, and I got to listen to it. And I was almost afraid to play that song, to get to that song. I was afraid that nothing would happen, that I would have no sense of that moment, but I did. It was there. And I could listen to the way Robbie Robertson played, and I could understand why anybody, me or anybody else, would have such an extreme reaction. Notes came together in a way that they never did before and never did again. I called up Robbie Robertson, who's a friend of mine, and I said, "Robbie, you know, that moment between the third and fourth verses of Highway 61 Revisited on Before the Flood, what was going on there? What were you trying to do?" I thought, to me, this had to be intentional. He said, "Oh, I remember that. I know what you're talking about." He said, "That was a moment of panic." He said, "I lost the beat. I had to get it back." And so here's just a traffic accident in the middle of the song. And to me, it's the best moment of the song. So you never know how it depends. Depends on who's playing and it depends on who's listening.
Vous voulez qu'on continue, Grêle Marcus, à écouter. Vous avez fait une petite sélection de ce que vous avez sorti de la boîte à vinyle de l'émission ici dans la discothèque de Radio France. Et sur le haut de la pile, il y avait ces 45 tours que vous avez entre les mains, notamment cette collection-là, les Sex Pistols. Est-ce que ça résonne pour vous?
Let's see here. Well, I mean, while we're on the subject of fanfares, mm-hmm. See, these packages are too complicated. We can listen to another fanfare. and this is, in some ways, this is so much cruder than what we listened to with Like a Rolling Stone. And yet it makes the same kind of promise. And it's a promise maybe that's kept even more than it is on Like a Rolling Stone. You'd have to play the whole record to hear all of that. I remember playing this record for a friend of mine. He's a very morbid guy. He's written many books about death. He even wrote a whole book about professions of death. But he's a very morbid, dark person. And I played him this record. He didn't know who the Sex Pistols were, didn't know anything about this kind of music. At the end of it, he was just shattered. He was a puddle. He said, "Don't play that again. I couldn't go through that again." He didn't mean he didn't like it. He meant, "I couldn't go through this again." And I think the fanfare of this record gives you an idea of why something like that might happen. I assume this is a 45.
Right. No, 45 tour.
And I think you can hear why somebody would be shattered by hearing this with no warning, with no preparation, with no familiarity, with not hearing any stories about punk or the Sex Pistols. The momentum in those opening moments, the urgency and the force and the cruelty in that sound is just overwhelming. And you know, I never noticed this before. The last single the Sex Pistols made, Holidays in the Sun, is dominated by the sound of marching feet, in hobnailed Nazi boots. And that's a sound that they have put onto the record, this stamp, 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 stamp. And the drumming at the very beginning of this record is the exact same sound at the exact same cadence. It has that ferocity to it. When you say, "I am actually here on Earth, and I was born, I'm going to die, and I don't know why I'm here, and what I'm going to do, and I realize I don't understand myself or anybody else. I am completely lost, but I have nowhere else to go." That's the existential dilemma, and that is rendered as powerfully in this record, or in any other form of rock and roll, as it is in any other art form, any other form of expression. And that's all. That's the only argument I have to make. That's it.
But there's nothing, really nothing to turn off.
Grel Marcus, aujourd'hui, la personne qui aurait le même comportement que vous en 63, 64 ou 68, quand vous avez commencé à écrire, par exemple dans Rolling Stone, s'intéresse à quelle contre-culture ? Quelle contre-culture, pas encore légitime, quelle contre-culture existe aujourd'hui ? Qu'est-ce qu'un jeune critique critique ?
You know, I never felt that I was part of a counterculture. And I never felt that I was looking into one. I always felt when I started that I was a part of American culture, and that was my subject. Now, when Ronald Reagan became president, I was so appalled, I felt like I couldn't even stay in my own country. And so in a kind of symbolic way, I didn't. I went to Europe, and I wrote a book about Europe. I didn't actually leave the country. I never wanted to do that. But in terms of my, you know, intellectual life, my emotional life, I really did for 9 years until he was gone. I started working on Lipstick Traces in 1980, the year he was elected, and I finished it in 1988, the year he left office, or the year he actually left office in 89. I finished, that's the year it came out. Thank you, Ronald Reagan, for letting me write that book. But I always felt I was writing about American culture, and I was writing about artists whose subject was America. And I think, you know, for any critic starting out today, his or her own subject is what speaks to them, what they're perplexed by. What asks them questions, whether it's a national culture, whether it's an ethnic culture, whether it's a single person in their lives who is an enigma, maybe someone who's introduced them to, you know, interesting movies, interesting people, but that person himself or herself still remains a kind of blank. And you start writing, maybe you don't even know this, in a way to ask yourself who that person is. In other words, why do people like what they like? Why do people fear what they fear? Because what I got from this person was a very intense sense that what you like is important and what you fear is important too, and you have to think about those things. I'm just making all this up. What I'm saying is follow what attracts you. Follow what is beautiful to you. And for many people, what's ugly, what's repulsive, has its own cast of beauty, its own irresistibility, its own seductiveness. Follow what you love, and see if your love grows or if your love withers. And I mean, follow the records you love, follow the novels you love, follow the, you know, odd, isolated, unexplained events in history that nobody else cares about, that you can't stop thinking about. That's all.
Oui, aller vers les énigmes, enquêter sur les énigmes pour que les énigmes restent encore plus belles, non pas pour les révéler, mais pour qu'elles soient encore plus belles, ce que vous écrivez dans les Lipstick Traces.
That's right.
Merci beaucoup, Grel Marcus, d'avoir été avec nous ce soir.
Thank
Merci.
You so much.
Et voilà, l'atelier du son avec Grel Marcus, c'est terminé pour ce soir. La vidéo qui reprend une partie de notre conversation se trouve donc sur radiovinyle.radiofrance.fr et le site de l'émission se trouve bien sûr sur franceculture.fr. La traduction ce soir des propos de Grel Marcus était assurée par Xavier Combe. L'atelier du son est préparé et coordonné par Inès De Bruyne avec l'aide ce soir de Victoire Després, à la réalisation Véronique Lamandour et au son ce soir Hervé Dubreuil et Sébastien Royer, mixage Bernard Lamiel. Merci aux équipes de la discothèque et notamment Marc Marais qui la dirige et Christian Charles qui a la responsabilité éditoriale de Radio Vinyle. Merci aussi à Maude Berthomier. Et on termine en ce moment avec Visions of Joanna de Bob Dylan qu'on a fini par retrouver. Dans un instant, vous retrouvez Aurélie Charron. Bonne suite de nuit à vous sur France Culture et à vendredi prochain.